Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors. Dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. March Madness is in full swing. We're down to the Sweet 16. College athletes playing their hearts out. A little later this hour, we're going to talk about the NCAA and why some people believe that college athletes should be paid. But my first guest today is Paul Shirley. Now, he's no stranger to March Madness. He played basketball for the Cyclones in the late 90s. After college, he pursued a pro career and played for 13 different professional teams at home and abroad. He wrote about those experiences in his first memoir, Can I Keep My Jersey? And his latest memoir focuses on a different type of game, his game off the court. It's called The Stories I Tell on Dates. And he is on the line with me now. Hello, Paul.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. I have to admit I'm a little bit nervous because I always forget that an interview over the phone is kind of like a date in a way. Like, we're going to sort of feel each other out a little bit at the beginning and see what we can talk about and what's a safe space and all of that.
Well, you're going to tell me some stories, I assume, which is apparently what you do when you go on dates. It's what most of us do. What made you want to write a book about it, ostensibly about your love life?
Well, it came about because I went on a lot of dates and I started to notice that a lot of the time I would kind of slide into similar stories that I had told before, almost like I was going into material. And at first that was kind of depressing. It made me feel like a bit of a psychopath. But then I started to pay attention and I realized that we all have these certain stories that kind of frame who we are and that we use to explain who we are really quickly. And that one of the places we do that frequently is on dates. I think because I have traveled so much and moved around a lot, I have been on more first dates than most people. So maybe I'm a little bit more aware of this, and perhaps I'm a little bit more polished at telling some of those stories than most people.
When you first started to collect these stories, to actually write them down and look at them as more of an overall narrative, not just a story that you tell in the course of a conversation, what did you start to discover about these stories?
Well, so as you can imagine, this book went through several iterations. It started off with me feeling very hubristic of hey, I've got these great stories. I'll just write them all down. And then the next iteration was, okay, we got to cull the herd a little bit and figure out which ones are worth telling or worth talking about. And then maybe in the third draft, that's when I started to connect to what was the lesson that I took away from that story? Not from the date itself, although that came later too, but starting to think about what did I learn about myself or what did I learn about the world in the course of going through this experience? And I would argue that that's what makes them kind of sing, if you will, is the fact that there is some learning that goes on. If I'm telling a story about, because we're on the topic, if I'm telling a story about a girl coming up to me in the Parks Library on the campus of Iowa State and asking me to sign a newspaper that features my crying face all over it, I don't know that I understood then what that meant, but in the course of writing all of this down, I think I was able to process it a little bit more and put it together. I see that a lot with memoir. I think one of the great benefits of writing memoir is that we can at least try to make sense of things. Sometimes we're deluding ourselves into believing that there's a purpose behind what the events we've gone through, but I think it helps us to see things through that lens of there's a story here, and now this makes sense to me.
A lot of the stories that you include in the book are about your childhood and about who you were as a kid. And you describe yourself as a pretty shy, nervous kid. I mean, maybe why don't you tell us one of your stories? Why don't you tell us a little bit about going to summer camp and introduce us to young Paul?
All right. So one of the first like vivid memories from being away from my parents was going to science camp, which also marks me as not a particularly cool fourth grader. But at this science camp, not all my friends, but three or four of my friends were there, and it was my first introduction to sort of sleepaway camp. And I remember being very excited about this until my mom walked out of the bunk area, and I realized, like, oh man, I've never been away from home. And I think that actually is sort of emblematic of my entire life. I've like really gotten excited about doing some kind of absurd things, going off to play basketball in Russia, going on dates in Barcelona, Spain. And then I'm hit all of a sudden with like, how did I get here? And in that context of the summer camp, I made it through the day and we saw an astronaut speak to us. And I thought I was doing all right until the sun went down and everybody went back to their bunks. And I was left feeling just sort of categorically alone with all of these strangers. And so went off to, I solved the problem in my head by thinking, oh, I'll call home and I'll just, you know, just get a little dose of home and that'll kind of make things okay. So I marched up to the front of the camp and the guy asked me like, hey, do you need a dime to make this phone call? Cause that's how long ago this was. And I said, no, I've got this. My dad taught me how to make a collect call, which was something I had never used a payphone because I'm from a tiny town in Kansas, but I was armed with this knowledge of like my dad wrote these instructions down. So I march up to the payphone and I dial the number you're supposed to dial and through all kinds of chaos, I'm getting more and more anxious about this because I'm having a harder and harder time doing this. I'm talking to this operator and she's not making sense of things. And so finally I get across that I want to make a collect call to home. And by then I'm like, okay, well, if I can do this, I'm going to say hi to my mom and then go back to camp and it'll be fine. I just need this little dose. And so the woman says, would you be willing to accept a collect call from Paul Shirley? And then my mom says, yes. And I'm feeling very bold about like, oh, I'm going to say, hi, mom, just everything's great. And then I head back to camp. And as soon as my mom's voice like trips the trigger over to now I have my agency on my end of the phone, my mom tells the story of all she heard was this, which was me bursting into tears at the sound of my mom's voice. And then she kind of got me calmed down and we talked and the sort of point of the story is that eventually I said, mom, could you just come get me tomorrow? I'm so homesick. I can't do this. And by her telling, it was one of those really difficult parenting moments where all she wanted to do was make things okay. But instead, she gave me these little achievable goals of like, well, just go back to your tent and, you know, brush your teeth and things will look a little better in the morning, while inside her heart was breaking and also probably my heart was breaking. So that's what I did and survived science camp. And I then took away from that this great lesson in my mom sort of toughening me up, not in an unloving way, but she made this decision that I needed to soldier through this and I was better off for it.
A lot of the stories that you tell in the book are about your childhood and about your vulnerability, about homesickness lasting well into college. As well. Mm-hmm. Being a professional basketball player, do you feel like you need to tell those stories to counteract the stereotype of what a pro ball player must be like?
Yeah, that's actually important to the structure of the book in general, and the structure of how I talk about myself. So I'm kind of this walking dichotomy of as maybe some people know, I have a degree in mechanical engineering, but I also played high-level college basketball. I have lived in, you know, all kinds of foreign countries and gone on dates with all sorts of amazing women, but I'm also still at heart this very kind of, I think, tender little kid from Meriden, Kansas. And I think we all are that. Right. So a lot of times we want to very quickly make someone understand that this impression of me that you have may not be correct. And people have certain impressions of a 6'9", 230-pound professional athlete. I'm tall and big, and I carry myself in a way that makes me seem kind of invincible at times. And so it's important for me, in order to just be able to relate to people, to say, like, no, that's not really who I am, nor is it who most people who are my size or of my former vocation are. I think we're the same as everyone else. And so probably the exercise of writing these two memoirs really was a way for me to remind people, like, hey, no, I'm really more like you than you realize.
Some of the stories that you tell about your professional basketball playing life seem a bit surreal, visiting the Playboy Mansion, getting the number of another girl in the parking lot outside a club where you went with one girl, you know, some of the things that little boy in Meriden, Kansas could never have imagined and maybe not aspired to. Has it been important for you sometimes to remind yourself of who you are?
For sure. I think obviously in the book, there's a dance between like wanting to portray the sort of extreme vulnerability that we all carry around, but also to give people a little bit of entertainment. So if I'm telling a story about being in Las Vegas at this insane concert and meeting some teachers on the floor of a casino, some of that is also like wish fulfillment. I've always had a little bit of a tendency to want to show people like, this is what the life can be like, while simultaneously undercutting that and showing like, unfortunately, I'm never able to participate in that the way that people want. But you're right. I think that there has always been a need for me to kind of remind myself of who I am, where I come from. This is kind of conceptual, but one time when I was in Russia was, it was definitely the most surreal place I've ever been for a lot of reasons. And it was so strange and so far away from normal at the time that I remember vividly that when I would get into the elevator to go back up to my room, I would see my face, and that would actually remind me, like, oh yeah, that's, I know this guy, like, I know who I am. But because everything was so strange around me, I sometimes forgot that, and I needed that reflection. And I suppose you could make the case metaphorically that having a book and being able to compose all of these stories does something similar.
We'll pick up on that in just a moment. I'm talking to Paul Shirley. His latest book is Stories I Tell on Dates. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest right now is Paul Shirley. He played basketball for the Cyclones in the late 90s. After college, he pursued a professional basketball career. He played for 13 different professional teams at home and abroad. He wrote about those experiences in his memoir, Can I Keep My Jersey? And he's got a new memoir out. It's called The Stories I Tell on Dates. And he's going to be doing an appearance in Iowa coming up at the Clive Library on April 13th. You can find out more about that. And Paul, you made a reference to a story that you tell in the book about a girl coming up to you in the Parks Library on the Iowa State University campus asking you to sign a photo of yourself. And this story follows a moment that, of course, many Cyclone fans, many basketball fans remember in your career. It was in 2000 when the Cyclones made it to the Elite Eight and then lost to Michigan State University. And you made a basket that didn't count, but it was a very strange call. A double foul is what they called it?
That's right. Yeah, it remains important in Iowa State basketball lore for reasons that I cannot control. But yes, the referees decided in that moment that they couldn't make a decision about whether it was a foul on me or a foul on the guy who I thought had run under me at the time. And there was a lot of other context to it, right? So not only was this an important game, but it was the game to determine who would go on to the Final Four. And we were playing Michigan State in Auburn Hills, Michigan. So there were about 20,000 Michigan State fans there. Additionally, the uncle that I'm sort of closest to in the world was in the stands with his son. And I had just come back from this wretched injury, this broken foot. And this was actually my first game back. So I was kind of amazed that I was playing as well as I was, and amazed that as I was running up and down the court, we were a couple of minutes away from going to this Final Four. And so I go crashing to the floor, and I think the player was Charlie Bell goes crashing to the floor, and I see that the referee has called the foul on Charlie Bell, and I'm thinking, oh, we're going to go up by four, and then I'll make the free throw, and we'll be up by five, or whatever the exact numbers were. And then I see the referees huddling, and I start thinking, uh-oh, this isn't great. And then they keep huddling, and our coach, Larry Eustace, is starting to lose his mind a little bit, and our fans, I'm sure, are doing the same wherever they are. And then they make this fateful call. They call a double foul, and so they take the basket away. There's going to be no free throw, and the ball goes to Michigan State. Importantly to me, I also foul out on this play, which is kind of integral to the game flow, because I wasn't the star of the team by any means, but I was a serviceable part of this whole situation. So I could only watch from the bench while Michigan State goes down and throws up an alley-oop to Morris Peterson, and the crowd goes crazy and our lead sort of dissipates, and then we lose the game. And I'm left at the end of the bench in all this turmoil, which is kind of exacerbated by the fact that our coach, Larry Eustace, completely lost his mind and got thrown out of the game, which added to kind of the last few minutes taking longer than they might have. And in this, as the Toradol that I've got coursing through my body to keep my foot from, you know, making me incapable of playing, starts to wear off and the magnitude of this all hits, I start crying. And not like cute crying, like full-on body spasms crying. And cameramen, as they are wont to do, manage to capture this moment. And so the game ends, and I'm still crying, and we get back to the locker room, and then somehow I get to the bus, and my uncle hugs me, and that causes me to start crying some more. And we get on the bus and get to Ames, Iowa, through an airplane ride and all of that. And then the next day I wake up, and I'm talking to my mom, and she says, oh, there's a picture of you, and they're using it all over the country. And I'm like, that's the breaks of being a college athlete, I suppose. And I'm telling myself, well, the good news is you're only a junior, and now you can at least rest this broken foot, and like maybe you guys will have a chance to come back, and you'll be in the same position next year, la, 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 la. So I go to bed that Sunday night, wake up on Monday morning thinking like, all right, well, you know, it's a bright new day in Ames, Iowa, which means it's, you know, only 35 degrees in April or whatever. And march off to class because they haven't canceled my engineering classes, and go to Friley Hall to get my huge breakfast to keep the weight on. And as I do every day, I pick up the newspaper. And as we know by now in this story, the whole paper is my crying face, which is about to be seen by 24,000 students. And so I think for a second, like, you could probably just go back to bed. But I didn't. I pushed through and had my breakfast, and then I went off to class, and people are pointing and saying hi and all that, and I'm just sort of taking it as I come. And then I get to the library, and I'm sitting there studying with my friend Dave, and this girl comes over and says, hey, are you Paul Shirley? And I'm like, oh, great. You know, it's cool. A girl's recognizing me. That's kind of awesome. And then I say yes, and she says, well, would you sign this for me? And I remember, like, in that moment, just being stunned all of, like, this person has to know how painful this was because it's in her hand. Like,
right, it's evident when you look at the picture.
In her hand. Maybe there's going to be worse moments in my life, but I don't know that I could express them in a more public way. And she has the nerve to say, will you sign this? And I think it hit me at that moment, like, oh, I'm not really a human being to her. Like, I'm just this kind of avatar. So I said yes and signed her newspaper, and she went on her way thinking that I, you know, was just kind of this video game character that existed for her basketball pleasure. And I left there thinking, people aren't necessarily that attuned to emotion sometimes.
When you share that story in the book, you share a just a devastating story of a moment where you actually almost died on the basketball court playing for the Bulls. And when you put all of these stories together, you've gone through this process of writing them, of crafting them. What do you think you learned about yourself in this process?
It's fun in a way because I have kind of forgotten about my past life. Like, I've really endeavored to leave a lot of that behind because now I'm in a different phase of my life, right? So I'm here in Los Angeles living in an apartment that's not at all very nice. And I run a writing workshop that is becoming successful, but is still very much kind of getting its feet. And I'm working on my next book, and I'm an adjunct professor at West LA College. But my life is very different from what it maybe once was or what it could have been based on the trajectory of the basketball side. So in a way, it was fun to look back at it because it reminds me, like, oh, deep breath. Okay, you have had a life before this, because sometimes I get really caught up in the immediacy of, like, I'm failing at what I'm doing. This isn't going to go well. This isn't going to work. And I think for me, a lot of this has been therapeutic in that I've been able to notice, like, oh, you've been through some difficult things before. You'll probably be okay again. You, as you mentioned, you survived having your kidney and spleen ruptured and almost dying on an airplane that was traveling from Indianapolis to Chicago. You can probably deal with writing up a business plan. So, and that's kind of one of the things that I hope people take away from the book too, is that I am, because I have been somewhat in the public eye throughout portions of my life, I am something of an avatar for people. And I hope that they can see that, like, this little kid who was so homesick in many situations or was so anxious about his middle school dance was able, in spite of or while he was experiencing those emotions, to go out and overcome some hardships and some failures. And that doesn't mean that I've gotten to a point now where I'm like, wow, everything's going to be gravy from here. I still feel these same things, but that's important to how we all are. We are all kind of burdened by concern and worry and anxiety about all of the things that might head our way.
You not only made yourself really vulnerable in this book by telling these stories about your childhood, about your life, about your feelings, you also share really intimate details of your dating life as well. I mean, this is a real exercise in vulnerability and being an open book. How does that feel with people reading these stories and talking to you about them?
I think that maybe seems stranger for people who read it than it does for me, in that I have been kind of an open book throughout my life since age 18, right? So one thing you get used to on the basketball court is that people are going to bring whatever they want to your experience of playing basketball. One of my my first coach at Iowa State, Tim Floyd, always said that he liked basketball the best of any of the sports because you can tell so much about a player when they're on the court by the simple fact that there's no helmet, there's no cap covering their face. And in a lot of ways, the fans are really close to the action. So you can see every bit of body language. You can see someone's character on full display. And I think I always felt that as a basketball player and enjoyed that. I really loved the idea of, like, I'm now out on the court. I can leave behind the person I am off the court. And I'm going to be in front of these people. And I'm going to be not wearing very many clothes. People forget, like, it's really exposing to stand in front of 15,000 people with nothing but a jersey and shorts on. And I'm going to try my very hardest at this thing. And they're going to be able to tell when I fail. Like, they're going to see it very quickly that, like, that play didn't go well or that play went perfectly. So to me, I guess some of those exercises in opening myself up on the page don't seem nearly as scary because of all of what I've been through as an athlete, which is that you have to expose yourself if you're going to be any good.
If you had not pursued a professional basketball career, I'm guessing you would have pursued an engineering career. Now you have pursued a professional basketball career, and here you are, a writer, a very, very different career path. Do you think a lot about what might have been?
I tend not to. I was with someone recently, actually on a date, who she's a biophysicist, I think, and I was talking about how when I was in high school, I think the path bifurcated more in high school than it did afterward, because really the difference between high school basketball and college basketball is vast and huge. The difference between college basketball and the professional basketball is not a thing. So anyway, when I think was in my parents' basement in Meriden, Kansas, seeing the college brochures come in from, on one hand, some mostly not very good basketball programs, because mostly I was recruited by some small schools until Iowa State came along. And then on the other hand, some really impressive academic schools. I think that was where that shift happened. And I made that decision. In fact, I can vividly remember I got accepted to Harvard. And that same uncle I was talking about before had gone to Harvard. And I told him on the phone, like, look, I'm not going to go to Harvard. I'm going to go to Iowa State and walk on and try to make it as a basketball player, because in my heart of hearts, I thought I'm good enough to be a professional basketball player. The problem was, you don't say that in Meriden, Kansas, and you don't say that when you're 6'8" and you weigh 195 pounds and no one's recruiting you. I just had this sense of things, and I think that's probably where I made that decision, was I'm gonna take Iowa State over kind of the sure academic path of going to Harvard. And I would argue that that's probably where this all kind of split off.
I'm talking with Paul Shirley. His latest memoir is Stories I Tell on Dates. He's going to be in Iowa on April 13th at the Clive Library. And Paul, I want you to stay with us, but I want to turn the conversation a little bit more to the experience of being an NCAA basketball player, being a college athlete. And I want to bring somebody else into the conversation who's also no stranger to college basketball. Native Iowan and former Wisconsin Badger Zach Bohannon is on the line with us, and he played in the NCAA tournament, I think, three times. Hello, Zach.
Hey, I appreciate you having me on the show, and it's an honor to be on with Paul Shirley, who kind of re-energized and kind of brought up the next generation of basketball players here in Iowa. I was obviously born and raised in Marion, Iowa, and I remember watching those great Paul Shirley teams with Marcus Fizer back in the late 90s, so appreciate you having me on.
Well, Zach, thank you so much for being here. And I want to talk to you both about the experience of being a college athlete. I know you both have some really strong opinions about college athletes as well. So maybe let's start with that. I mean, Zach, tell us what it's like, what your life was like as a student and an athlete in Wisconsin.
No, absolutely. It was one of those, I had a unique experience. I was actually kind of just like Paul mentioned, I heard the tail end of his conversation. I was actually a mid-major recruit. I had recruiting letters come in from the small and mid-major colleges all across America. And I chose to start my career actually at the Air Force Academy. And so I had a unique perspective where I actually went off to a military academy to play basketball. And at the time, it was one of the top conferences in the country, in the Mountain West Conference, with BYU, UNLV, and San Diego State. Some great programs. And after 2 years there, I ended up transferring to Wisconsin. And I kind of took the same route that Paul mentioned. I really cared about my education, but at the same time, I knew that I only had a certain amount of time to play basketball. And I just saw how that jump, the difference between high school and college, it's not about the student-athlete anymore. It's about athletics. And you literally are put into a basketball program to make money for the school. And I ended up getting two masters in undergrad in economics during my time while I played. But that was almost near impossible for any normal student to do such a thing because of the time constraints that you're put under as an athlete.
Yeah, well, give me an idea. What was a normal week like during the basketball season?
Well, the biggest example that I can give that I like to talk about is my senior year. I was captain of the 2014 Wisconsin Final Four team, and I was in my MBA program. I had already got my undergrad. I had already got a master's in political communication, and I was working on my second master's degree, and we went off and we were playing in the NCAA tournament the first weekend, which we just saw last weekend for the NCAA tournament that just took place. Was we traveled on a Tuesday, played on a Thursday, won our first game in the opening round, had another game on Saturday. We turned around and got back on Sunday morning. We ended up making it to the Sweet 16, so we turned around again on Tuesday to play our game on Thursday. We won that, played in the Elite Eight on Saturday to go to the Final Four, which meant we turned around, went back home from Los Angeles, Anaheim, where we played at, and we turned around back on Monday to go down to Dallas after playing one day or going to one day of classes, and then played in the Final Four that Friday or that Saturday night, and we were there for 4 days before the game had even took place. And so, long story short, we missed 11 to 14 school days. And I was like, okay, if this is really about the student athlete, why are we missing all this class time?
Well, and I'm sure it was at the same time when many of your fellow students were stressing out about midterms. So we're going to
exactly.
take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking basketball this hour. With me is former Wisconsin Badger Zach Bohannon and also Paul Shirley, who played for the Cyclones and 13 different pro teams in his professional career. His latest memoir is called Stories I Tell on Dates. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We've got a couple of great basketball players with us this hour. With me, Paul Shirley, who played for the Cyclones and had a pro career after that, played for 13 different professional teams at home and abroad. He wrote about those experiences in his first memoir, Can I Keep My Jersey? And he's got a new memoir out. It's called Stories I Tell on Dates. Also with us now, Zach Bohannon, who played for the Wisconsin Badgers, and he's had a big basketball focus year or a couple of years, even though he's not playing ball anymore. He's traveled 35,217 miles and gone to 67 games to watch his brother, Jordan, play for the Hawkeyes. We'll talk about that a little bit later on. But right now we're talking about what it means to be a student athlete, to be a part of the NCAA. And Paul, just before the break, Zach was describing daily life for a ball player in Wisconsin. It sounds a lot like what you describe from your days at Iowa State.
Yeah, it's. I think Zach can probably speak to this. We dance around this because it's usually not toward to use this comparison, but it's very militaristic. Your life is kind of taken over by a schedule, and you've got someone screaming at you a lot of the time. And I think that what is tricky for people to understand is that it isn't like an extension of high school basketball. I catch some blowback pretty often because I am vocal about how difficult that experience was. And a lot of the sense I get from people is, I would have given anything to have been in your shoes. And I get that, because when I was in high school, I would have given anything to get to play for Kansas or Kansas State or even Iowa State, as I ended up playing. But it's really not the same once you get into the grinder of it. And once you start understanding how much money is being made, and once you start seeing, like, this coach who's screaming at me and who's making my life hell is making $1 million or $2 million or $4 million or whatever the number is, and I actually know that I have $6 in my wallet, and I'm going to have to decide, like, can I afford to go buy a hamburger to sort of offset the fact that we just used 3,000 calories in this practice, or can I not? Like, I just don't know that it's fair anymore.
Well, and Zach, when you went to school, you actually had an interesting awakening to your feelings about the NCAA and your strong feeling that college athletes should be paid, should be compensated. Tell me about that. I mean, this started with a debate class, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I transferred, and Paul did a great job explaining just the militaristic lifestyle that college athletes are put under, and I can speak exactly on behalf of that. I was at a military school, and my life didn't change very much when I transferred them from the Air Force Academy to the University of Wisconsin. If anything, it got even more militaristic because it was a larger stage and a larger profile with a coach making more money and an athletic budget that was in the hundreds of millions of dollars instead of having an extracurricular activity at the Air Force Academy. So when I got to the University of Wisconsin, I actually took a debate class, and Communications 262 is what it was, and it was a free elective for my econ undergrad degree as I was finishing out my undergrad in 3 years. And I took this class, and you could argue whatever subject you wanted. And for me, it was my first semester at Wisconsin. I thought I was living life. I was like, okay, I don't have this military lifestyle anymore. I can do what I want, come and go. I was a redshirt transfer. I wasn't able to travel with the team. And so my view was like, okay, I'm going to do the typical pay-for-play debate, and I'm going to argue that athletes shouldn't be paid. And I took the top arguments, and the more and more I started researching, especially from an economics perspective, and then I read The Shame of College Athletics by Taylor Branch, who I was fortunate enough to have the opportunity to meet and sit down with and talk to, who literally describes college athletes as, and I don't like to use this term lightly or his analogy, but he calls college athletes as having comparison to the whiff of the plantation, as in slaves, they're unpaid labor. And that's what they truly are. I know they get some revenue distributed back to them in the form of scholarship, but at the same time, these coaches who are making millions of dollars and these athletic departments are making hundreds of millions of dollars by college football and college basketball players, the money that they're getting in revenue is pittance compared to what should be given. In a typical collective bargaining agreement in the NBA or NFL, you get roughly 50% back to the athletes that are contributing their labor to the process. In college athletics, it's under 10%, and it's just outrageous that this model has continued to exist, and the student athlete sham term that is used by these coaches who literally don't even let you pick your major. If your major conflicts with your practice schedule, guess who wins in that argument? It's not the player. The major is chosen by the coaches and by the academic staff to make sure that you're not put under enough pressure to not fulfill your potential on the court.
So what would you propose doing instead?
The biggest thing, and I know a lot of people get upset when we say the pay-for-play model, and I don't necessarily believe in pay-for-play per se, but the biggest thing that I think that can be instituted without any doubt is that the NCAA should be able to implement the Olympic model. And the Olympic model is that athletes can use, are literally responsible for their and own their name, image, and likeness. And right now in college athletics, you literally sign over your name, image, and likeness to your school and to the NCAA, and you can't profit off of. For example, I wanted to write a book and write some blogs that I would get paid for, but I wasn't able to use my own name and use my own name, image, and likeness to put out some of these blogs and put out some of these articles to the CBSs of the world because the NCAA owns your name, image, and likeness. And the Olympics actually went away from that up until a few decades ago and then implemented it after the fact, and they said that it would blow up the whole entire Olympics. But at the end of the day, the Olympics have been as strong as ever, even with the Olympic model in place and getting rid of amateurism.
Well, and that would help the students who are successful, the standouts, the people whose names and faces we really recognize. What about those other students toiling along with them?
Well, it would help all involved. So it's the same. The other analogy I like to use, why should a student athlete have different rights or any less rights than what a normal student does at the University of Wisconsin? For example, let's do an English major. An English major or a musician student who comes in on a full academic ride who's majoring in English or who's majoring in music at the University of Wisconsin, they can go off and perform and use their special talent that they've been given to go make money by go performing in a different venue or go making money by going for an English major to go sell a book with their own name and make royalties off of that, where a student athlete isn't able to, which is just crazy to think that you're treated as a second-rate citizen in a semi-professional, and I know Paul would argue even a professional environment that college athletics truly is.
Well, and Paul, what are your thoughts about this? How do you think we should solve this problem?
Well, I think as Zach and I bandy about on this, we have to remember that he and I were kind of the fortunate side of this. I always have to remind people that, like, this model actually worked okay for me. I got to play professional basketball, and I've had a pretty great life, and I'm still in touch with Iowa State people, and they've given a lot to me. But I think the biggest farce about all of this is people aren't actually getting degrees. So people will say, like, well, you know, the guy's getting a scholarship out of the deal. But a scholarship is kind of meaningless unless you actually graduate. Like, just doing 2 years at a school is not particularly helpful. I mean, it's better than maybe zero, but it doesn't really advance your life very much. So I wonder, and I like the proposal that we're talking about of, like, being able to use your own likeness. If you were a model and somebody said, hey, you're studying fashion, we want to pay you $100,000 to be on the runway, nobody would stop you from that. But I also wonder if there's maybe a way to tie it to graduation rates, put money into a trust so that if you survive these 4 years and you graduate, you leave with $150,000 or something like that. I think people have to remember that there were a lot of guys, when I was at Iowa State, the graduation rate, and I'm not joking about this, was something like 8% for men's basketball. That's not people getting degrees and getting a scholarship and making use of that. That's just people saying, hey, they're getting a scholarship, so we can feel better about ourselves, while the entire college athletics umbrella makes a ton of money.
Well, and this is it's a hard sell, especially for those of us who maybe struggled to pay for our own tuition. Here's an email from Scott in Cedar Rapids. He says, while I wholeheartedly agree that especially big universities make money on the big sports, I do understand how an athlete might feel like they should get a stipend or a paycheck when they see the massive dollars that are brought into the university because of their playing. What I feel is often forgotten is the tuition, room and board are covered. At a state school in Iowa, that $20,000 to $25,000 a year plus extra help with tutors and class scheduling. If you graduate with a BA, you've gotten an education that many people pay thousands of dollars for. Student athletes are paid and have a grueling schedule to follow. Many non-athletes have a work schedule of 20 to 40 hours a week, not to have cash in their pockets, but to pay their U-Bell. I mean, Zach, this is a really hard sell. I mean, you're not proposing that the student athletes actually get a salary or a stipend, but a lot of people are just going to say, yeah, cry us a river, right?
Absolutely. So just the numbers, and I agree with that. Yes, you get a tuition, you get payment. So my argument on the other end is, and I made this argument to my dad, who my dad believes in the full intangible benefits of what you experience. My dad played football at Iowa, and he believes the intangible benefits on what you get on those incredible moments on being a part of a great team or being a part of a college sports program like our family has been a part of and Paul experienced at Iowa State. But at the same time, and I made the argument saying that, look, okay, if that's the case, if you think that you should be able to cap the compensation at just tuition and that once-in-a-lifetime experience of being a college athlete, then all right, let's go ahead and cap the coaches. Why can't they? Let's put the same rules and the same institutional policies in place for student athletes as coaches, where they can't take another job. If they take another job, they have to sit out a year. They're not able to take advantage of their name, image, and likeness and not sign endorsement deals. They cap their salaries at $150,000 or $200,000 a year on the free market, and they're not able to take advantage of the free market system that they currently are able to make the millions, the $2 to $3 to $4 million that some of the coaches. And all the people who I say that to, they're like, oh, that makes no sense. I'm like, okay, if it doesn't make any sense, then why does it make sense for the college athlete? Because all those same rules are in place, and we're trying to make a living just like everyone else, because this is the start of our life. When you're 18 and you go off to the military, that's when you grow up to become a man. So if you're getting denied these rights that the typical coaches or the typical students at your same level are getting, then why does it make sense for the student athlete too? And I haven't been able to get an argument back from those Scots in Cedar Rapids or anyone else who make that argument.
Well, and we could talk about this all day. I do want to turn the conversation before we run out of time, Zach, to one of those magic moments that your family very recently experienced. I mentioned that for the last couple of years, you made a commitment to go see your little brother, Jordan Bohannon, play for the Hawkeyes every single game, which is a huge commitment on your part. And then you were part of a really incredible moment this season. Jordan was on an incredible streak of free throws, and he was on pace to break the Hawkeyes' consecutive free throw record, which, of course, is held and set by Chris Street, a player who was killed in a car accident when he was a junior on the Hawkeye team in 1993. Bohannon went up to the line with the Hawkeyes up 73-65, and he left it short, tying Street's record instead of beating the record. And I want to play just a moment from a recent piece that was done on the NPR show, Only a Game, that we also get to hear the voice of Chris Street's mother in this clip about that special moment.
Yeah, obviously that's not my record to have, and obviously that record deserves to stay in his name.
I'm like, oh, Jordan, you shouldn't have done that for, you know, Christopher. You shouldn't have done that. You know, that's what I kept telling myself. But then as you have time to think, and you're like, wow, what an incredible, incredible act of respect and kindness.
Again, that was just a moment from a piece on Only a Game about this moment, and that was the voice of Jordan Bohannon and then the voice of Patty Street, Chris Street's mother. And Zach, this was actually an idea that came from a conversation that you and your brother had, right?
Yeah, for sure. It was one of those things that Jordan was nearing the record. He was getting up into the early to mid-20s on consecutive free throws made, and when he got to that point, he was still obviously a 8 to 10 free throws away from tying the record, but I just made sure as I have gotten really close with him, as I've been close with him my entire life, we've always shared a special bond, but as I continue to grow closer to him, going to all of his games, I gave him a quick call and told him, you know how you're going to continue on with this record? He goes, yeah, I think I have an idea. And I go, no, there's no hesitation. You have to be 100% certain, because when the moment comes, you can't doubt yourself. And so we kind of played it out a month prior to that and had everything talked through, and it didn't exactly go as we had planned, like we had talked and discussed, but it still ended up being a neat moment for him, and I think he did ultimately the right thing in the end.
Well, and he actually looked up at you in the stands for confirmation before he missed that free throw, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, and it was kind of a unique situation because there was 2 minutes and 15 seconds left in the game. They were just blown a 22-point lead to Northwestern and got to 7 at the time. And Coach McCaffrey, as coaches normally are, was going irate that the players were letting the opposing team get back into the game. And he got fouled. He had already tied it early in the first half, and it was at this late moment in the game that he got fouled and was on the ground. He immediately stood up and looked over at the stands at me in the seventh row and just stared at me for like 10 seconds, like looking like, do I miss it? Is this the situation to do it to? And I just like stared at him back. And then finally, after the 5 to 10 seconds, I just gave him a nod and a thumbs up. And he saw and just went to the line and did as we had discussed.
Wow. And how did you feel at that moment?
I mean, I was proud. I ended up giving a heads up to my mom. I always sit next to my mom, and then my dad's two seats down, and then my younger brother and his girlfriend are next to me on my right. And I told my mom, like, hey, I just want to let you know he's going to miss this. And he's like, or she goes, what are you talking about? Why is he going to miss it? I said, it's the right thing to do. And she's like, all right, whatever, I believe you. And she didn't understand, like, truly at the magnitude. And then when he did miss it, I saw Coach McCaffrey yell, as Jordan later told me. He got mad that he missed it. Not thinking anything, that he was just not concentrating. And then my dad got mad, and he didn't understand what he was doing either. And then finally, once my mom told him and it kind of got out to her family, he's like, oh, that's kind of cool. And then it kind of blew up from there and became a national news story, which I knew it was going to be a pretty big story. I figured it would get picked up by the Sports Center, local news and whatnot, but I did not think it was going to be a national news story where it would be on NBC nightly news and so forth.
Well, and those moments of magic on the basketball court aren't always about winning, are they?
Exactly, and that's what I think the biggest thing, and why Iowa, in general, just the Iowa values that Iowa stands for, including going back to the Kinnick Stadium, the way for the Children's Hospital to basketball, it's kind of put Iowa athletics on the map that, look, it's more than just a game. It's about those special moments and about doing it for the right reasons. And yes, you can win and lose, but at the end of the day, it's about the people that you surround yourself with and the values that you stand for as an athlete and as a state or community. And I think that's what Iowa did a great job representing in those moments this season.
Well, Zach Bohannon, thanks for talking to me today.
No, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Native Iowan and former Wisconsin Badger Zach Bohannon. And Paul Shirley, thank you so much.
Thank you. Great talk. Glad to meet you all over the phone. I'm glad this date went well.
Paul Shirley, his latest memoir is Stories I Tell on Dates. He's going to be at the Clive Library coming up on April 13th. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.